I'm very grateful to the Freud Museum for very kindly hosting this evening, and it's a great pleasure to be here because there couldn't be a better place to do a launch of anything, really. So I'll go straight in and not waste any more drinking and canapé time. So that's my title, and this is the cover of the book. So I'm here really to introduce this new translation of Didier Anzieux's Le Moi Pur into English. This is the first translation that's based on the full final edition of 1995, though actually I've also included the last chapter of the previous, the 1985 edition as well, because it has many interests of its own. I'll talk about Anzieux in a minute, but I'm going to start by some thoughts about translation in general. Studies of translation and translators' prefaces tend to open with ringing declarations. Here are some examples, in no particular order. It's also all in the handout if you look at it. I'll quickly read them through, I think. So, all translation is to some extent misrepresentation. Most translators try to make themselves invisible. Translation is always interpretation. Translation involves the murder of the original. The translator is usually a shy character. Because of his humility, he has chosen such an insignificant occupation. That's 1937, Ortega y Gasset. The great pest of speech is frequency of translation. That's Dr. Johnson. The writer who is content to destroy is on a plane with the writer who is content to translate. Both are parasites. Translatorship amounts first and foremost to being able to play a social role, to fulfill a function allotted by a community. And finally, all translation starts with an act of trust. I'll come back to that one. And now here are some famous translated ones. I guess everybody knows traduttore, traditore, translator, traitor. This one you can actually translate into English with at least the sound coming out right. And then the French one, which I have to say I find quite amusing, but it's terribly sexist, obviously. La traduction est comme la femme. Si elle est belle, elle n'est pas fidèle, et si elle est fidèle, elle n'est pas belle. So the faithful and the beautiful, and I'll come back to that in a moment. The literature of translation studies is by now considerable and fascinating, but I want to reduce it, with shortness of time, down to two pairs of contrastive issues, which divide or distinguish areas that theorists choose to emphasize, sides they choose to take on a process that is, by definition, a movement from one side to another. So the first one is beauty and fidelity. I hope you've actually got the handout, because there may be more copies, because some of these longer quotations are just in the handout for you if you want them. So we've just seen the popular contrast between the faithful and the beautiful in translations. The sexism is no coincidence, though it maps oddly, or not, onto the fact that in these two aphorisms, the translator is male, while the translation is female. This despite the general view that the humble or invisible role of translator is mainly taken by women, while the source text authors are mainly men. And this is a sort of just habit of tradition, but it's significant, I think. In an interesting blog in French, Claire Pascial highlights another rather nasty paragraph about, this is quote 3, le viol fécond, somebody's talking about translation there, which links it to different ways of using la langue maternelle, the mother tongue. In this connection, Barbara Johnson, in 1985, made a comment so witty that I'm going to quote it in full. This is quote number 5 on your handout, if you have it. She says, while the value of the notion of fidelity is at an all-time high in the audiovisual media, this is 1985, but I don't know if it's changed, its stocks are considerably lower in the domains of marital mores and theories of translation. It almost seems as though the stereo, the Betamax, and the Xerox have taken over the duty of faithfulness in reproduction, leaving the texts and the sexes with nothing to do but disseminate. This is perhaps the inevitable result of the intersection between contemporary psychoanalytical, Marxist, and philosophical critiques of consciousness on the one hand, and modern technology on the other. When computers, automated assembly lines, and photocopiers advantageously replace human memories and hands, and when language, ideology, and the unconscious are aptly compared to machines of which we are the puppets, it's difficult to know what to do with that defensive excrescence called consciousness. I hope I'm saying this in the right place. For while both translators and spouses were once bound by contracts to love, honour and obey, and while both inevitably betray, the current questioning of the possibility and desirability of conscious mastery makes that contract seem deluded and exploitative from the start. But what are the alternatives? Is it possible simply to renounce the meaning of promises or the promise of meaning? She goes on. Fortunately, I must address translation, not matrimony. Yet the analogy between the two is extremely far-reaching. It might, however, seem that the translator ought, despite or because of his or her oath of fidelity, to be considered not as a duteous spouse, but as a faithful bigamist, with loyalty split between a native language and a foreign tongue. And she continues, this bigamist is doubly unfaithful, but in such a way that he or she must push to its utmost limit the very capacity for faithfulness. And this brings me then to the second contrastive pair. And that is contrasting the person who's bi or multilingual on the one hand and the person who's monolingual on the other hand. To my surprise, perhaps it's too obvious, but that's rarely a problem with theory. No one seems to raise the very fundamental contrast between the position of the bi- or multilingual person and that of the monolingual, with the essential reservation that almost everyone has a mother tongue, which they know better than any other language, and in the main this should be their target language. Translators are always bi- or multilingual, whereas the people they're writing for are in principle and generally in actuality monolingual. This is surely the fundamental paradox of the whole activity. You're creating a product that hides not just its origin, but the very practice that has brought it into being, your labour. Actually, of course, arguably, this is often true. This is true of an art. Flaubert makes an exception by moaning all the time about what a pain it was to write the book. So everybody knows he put labour into it. But generally, of course, if you've written a text that's successful, your labour may not be very visible. But this, it seems to me, to be actually not so much invisibility as something a bit more like suicide. Or to use another metaphor, it's the paradoxical state of creating a person who will be not of unknown father, but of unknown mother. This is actually not an unknown phenomenon, this phenomenon. In the 18th and early 19th century, some children were actually declared to be of unknown mother, with various kind of political background and consequences. Because after all, it's only at the moment of birth that you can say, this is quote 6, mama's baby, papa's maybe. And this is indeed part of what I would think of as the feminization of translation, not just as a profession, but as a principle. I'm going to be political now. To be multilingual or monolingual is a political difference. It belongs in the burgeoning area of post-colonial translation theory. But in principle, it's larger than that. For the more languages one knows, the lower one's status. Servants and wives need to speak at least two idiolects, and migrant peoples are always seen as lacking the key monolingual skills that their hosts take for granted. I mean, I'm speaking in Britain, so. And in some ways what it means is that somebody could be suspect by reason of their greater knowledge. Ignorance is power. I'm not going to pursue this any further, but I'd like to relate it to the peculiarity of the relationship between translation as an activity and a theory, and translation as an outcome. When we theorize about translating, we are always in a relation, looking at a relation of plurality, the task or source text, the person solving the series of pitfalls and booby traps that is the job in hand, and the general issues of a specific or global relation between languages. But this means nothing to the person we're actually addressing in the act of service we are engaged upon. He or she is someone who can't judge if we've done it well or badly, who is, in other words, totally dependent on us to have cooked the perfect souffle, danced the perfect ballet, because they don't see the eggs or the blisters that precede it. And, of course, if you actually do compare translations, you sometimes find something like, I was looking at a piece of Freud, actually, where Strachey, who I'll come on to in a moment, and who is, I think, not that bad, but he missed out the word not. It was actually had a sort of significance. Only if the translation then is actually so bad that it doesn't sound like anything in the target language, and often not even then. I'm going to quote now a bit from Benjamin's essay about translation. This is actually from the translation. He's quoting somebody called Adolf Panvitz, and he says, Our translators, even the best ones, proceed from a wrong premise. They want to turn Hindi, Greek, English into German, instead of turning German into Hindi, Greek, and English. It's something we could come back to, actually, because I find that quite problematic, but it's certainly an interesting question. So as a multilingual serving the needs and wishes of the monolingual, the translator is like the three-year-old girl who is told that if her older brother can't do up his shoelaces as she can, she should get down and help him. No wonder then that translators are endlessly fascinated by what they do, how hard it is, and which particular bits drive them mad, and so on. So with this, I'm going to turn from translation in general to saying a bit about the translation of Freud, and particularly the standard edition. Okay, these are on two occasions in the not so distant past, I have co-organized events examining the issues of translations of Freud. The first was a conference in 1986, which is the one where three of us sat on the couch, and it included a panel on the subject of translating Freud, and that was followed by a co-edited volume called Freud in Exile in 1988. The five contributors to the book section reappear here or there in the discussion that follows. All the more as one of them, Darius Gray Ornston, went on to publish an important collection of his own called Translating Freud, which I very much recommend to anybody interested in this question. More recently, I was involved in running at the Institute of Germanic and Romance Studies, where I was director, a two-year project on psychoanalysis and the arts and humanities, a multilingual perspective, covering our main five or six languages. And one of the things we did at the opening, we had an opening conference called Freud in Translation, Freud in Transition, which is one on your right. And we opened that with looking at a couple of paragraphs of Der Dichter und das Fantasieren, they're different translations of the name of that short essay, Creative Writers and Daydreaming, in a whole pile of different languages and compared what happened. And the other thing that we did was to create a grid of keywords from Freud and the translations. I'll leave that up for a while because it is really interesting, but you've also got it in the handout. Perhaps just worth mentioning, there are two Spanish versions. One was by a Spanish translator and the other by an Argentinian translator. And I think there are a number of sort of very interesting differences. And also at the time of the conference, which is whenever it was, 10 years ago or so, there were no fewer than three French translations, just of that essay, and each one had a different title. Those are in your handout. Fortunately, I don't have time to go through all the details of the history of the translation of Freud until it ended up in the hands of Strachey, but I'm just going to show you a few pictures to take you through. So that's A.A. Brill, who did some very important early work. Joan Rivière, Freud with Ernest Jones. And this is the Strachey family, and I found this in a rather wonderful book about them. And I just would like to... I don't know, does anybody know, or can anybody guess which one is James? You might already know. He's the little one, the little boy, the one at the end, left at the top, and so on. You can find... These pictures must all have been taken on the same day. And some more of James going along the top and Alex's wife. Okay, so as you know, James Strachey is the author of the standard edition, though of course he was working with a team which included beside himself the main other protagonists, Alex Strachey, Anna Freud and Angela Richards. His translation, with its massive editorial framework and thorough cross-references, has been used as a model by readers of every language, including German. And his own notes often display scruples over certain translation choices. But in the last 30 years particularly, it's come in for an awful lot of criticism, some of which I shall touch upon. But here is an example. You can see some adjectives used, and other sort of adjectives and so on, used of both the Strachey work and the Freud style. And if you've got the handout, all the references are there, but it just gives quite a nice picture. There's Freud being dialogic, enchanting and skittish, and there's Strachey being accused of being stiff and masterly. So there clearly is a certain amount of problem, and yet I think perhaps he's not doing quite so badly as people often say. So I'm just going to look at a few of the key words. And the first one of the most contentious, I guess, is the way he translated the cluster, das Ich, das Es, and das Über-Ich, as ego, id, and superego. Famously contentious. A glance at the grid. Oh, it's a bit back. Okay. A glance at the grid reveals. Oh, sorry. Forward or back?
Forward.
Forward. Sorry. Yes. reveals that English is the only one of the four target languages that we were looking at that doesn't follow Freud's lead in representing the three elements of the structural model of the psyche by the ultra-simple words I, it, and so on, although obviously with a capital, so it's slightly different. Although one of my lodgers, who is Russian, I don't know if she's here, Russian-speaking, maybe she's here somewhere, she told me that actually they say ego and id in Russian as well. Bruno Bettelheim, who abhors the soulless, what he calls the soulless scientism of Strachey, describes ego and id as, this is quote, 12 cold technical terms which arouse no personal associations. Ornstein actually steps in to defend Strachey by noting, he says, we now know that the Stracheys and John Rickman, and Leonard Wolfe also was involved, vigorously opposed Jones's choice for the ego and the id, and we know that Jones turned the tide, but we do not know how or why, which is quite interesting. So a lot of the stuff that's thrown at Strachey, obviously he went ahead with the ego and the id, but that was not necessarily the choice he made. One of the recent retranslators of Freud, Sean Whiteside, raises a practical problem. He thinks it's really going to be difficult to find a plural, for example, for the it. What would you say? The its. And I'm going to give you a final twist, which is a weird little story. Well, not a story, really. It was something that Strachey wrote to his wife, Alex, in what he called, in the midst of the dispute. This is quote 14, if you have the handout. He says, the little beast, that's obviously Jones, the little beast is really most irritating. They want to call das S the id. I said I thought everyone would say the yid. So Jones said there was no such word in English. There's Yiddish, you know, and in German, Jude, but there's no such word as Yid. Pardon me, doctor, Yid is a current slang word for a Jew. Ah, a slang expression. It cannot be in very widespread use then. Simply because, says James, the LB, which stands for little beast, hasn't ever heard of it. And I don't have much time, so I'm going to go straight ahead for the other kind of big one, if you like, which is the word Seele, translated as in Strachey as generally as either psyche or when adjectival as mental. This is the leading issue in Bruno Bettelheim's impassioned polemic Freud and Man's Soul. It was in 1983 that he published it. As I've mentioned, he was inveighing against both Strachey's scientific choices and also implicitly or maybe explicitly at times against the American psychoanalytic exclusion of non-medically qualified people from practicing psychoanalysis. So he's talking to the American context. And he shows how often Freud uses the word Seele, soul, in context where Strachey translates it as psyche, which obviously means soul in Greek, but looks Greek rather than meaning soul when one reads it in English reading. And often in adjectival or compound form, Strachey will use the word mental. Part of the problem is that Freud uses Seele and Psyche almost interchangeably. He uses them both with great frequency. Now, Bettelheim says this is quote 16, such substitutions are particularly misleading because in German the word Seele and Seelisch have even more exclusively spiritual meanings than the word soul has in present-day American usage. Bettelheim was born in Vienna in 1903, but he had lived in America since 1939. Ornstein, whose German is obviously extremely good, he objects to this and says, this is quote 17, although the English soul has stayed spiritual, by Freud's time, die Seele had a scientific use. Seelenkunde and Seelenlehre meant psychology. So, there we are. Intervening on this debate in 2002, Louise A.D. Hewish, who did one of the new translations in the Penguin series, slices this Gordian knot, I think, rather brilliantly. She says, where Strachey consistently translates Seele and its cognates in a very narrow sense as mind or mental, I have opted for the adjective inner, translating Seelenleben, for example, as inner life. And actually, when I sent a version of this to a professional translator, he said, oh, that's a really good... And he translates from Russian, and he said, oh, that's such a good solution because it occurs a lot in Russian too. Okay, now I want to turn to the main figure of this evening, and that's Didier Anzieux, but I have to kind of belt through some of these others. Okay. I'm going to begin the story of Anzieux's life 35 years before his birth, a bit anecdotally, but it seems to me a very interesting background. On the 8th of July, he was born on the 8th of July 1923. This is something that happened in, 10th of December 1890. There happened to a five-year-old girl in the family, a family called Pantaine. And there are two versions of the event, and I'm going to give you both, and they're on the handout. First one. The family talk a lot about a violent emotion the mother suffered while she was pregnant with my patient. The eldest daughter died as the result of a tragic accident. She fell before her mother's very eyes into the wide-open door of a lighted stove and died very rapidly of severe burns. And the second one. My mother was the third child in the family, the third or fourth. That's the problem. Before her, in fact, three daughters were born. The family lived in a large stone house close to the stable and the fields. The main room was heated by a large fireplace filled with big burning logs, and there were benches in it that you could sit on. This happened before my mother was born. It was a feast day. Marguerite, the youngest of the three daughters, had an organdy dress on, ready to go to church. She'd been left for a moment in the charge of the eldest girl, the one who was to become my godmother. The child was lightly dressed. It was cold. She went up to the fire to warm herself and was burnt alive. It was a dreadful shock for the parents and her two sisters. So my mother was conceived as a replacement for the dead child. I have to say in brackets, I'm running a conference with my friend Jean over there in December on replacement, and as we've left a call for papers out. He goes on, as a replacement for the dead child. And since she was another girl, they gave her the same name, Marguerite, the living dead in a way. It's no coincidence that my mother spent her life finding ways to escape from the flames of hell. It was a way of accepting her fate, a tragic fate. My mother only spoke openly of this once, but I knew it as a family legend. I think her depression goes back to this untenable position. If you look carefully at the two versions, they're different in an awful lot of ways. They do show how a family legend, which then becomes a fate carried through several generations, twists and turns. So, was the dead girl the eldest or the youngest? I'm happy to say there is a wonderful book by somebody called Jean Alouche about this whole story of Marguerite. And he tells you what, so I can tell you too. So, the question comes up. Was the dead girl the eldest or the youngest? Was it a gaping stove or an inglenook fireplace? Was it a sister or the mother who witnessed the terrible event and should have been taking better care? Was the mother pregnant when it happened? Or did she become so to replace her lost daughter, whether firstborn or lastborn? What the two versions agree on is the shock to the whole family and the long-lasting effects, not just on the parents and living sisters, but on the siblings that followed. In fact, the child who died was the eldest, not the youngest, of the three sisters, which of course shows you that the other sister who was there couldn't really have been looking after her. The mother Jeanne was not pregnant with the second Marguerite when the first was killed, but possibly with a baby who was stillborn the following August. So the second Marguerite was born in July 1892. The first version that I've just cited is that of Jacques Lacan, who met Marguerite Pantaine, by then Marguerite Anzieux, in April 1931, when she was arrested and then sectioned for attacking a famous stage actress with a knife. Lacan wrote his doctoral thesis on Marguerite Anzieux under the pseudonym of Aimée, using her case history as a prototype of the role of personality in psychopathic development. Didier was her second child, the replacement for a sister who had died of birth, so he's the replacement child of a replacement child. He, in his case, replacing a child of the other sex and in the other case of the same sex, and these are all interesting differences. From 1949 to 1953, after hearing Lacan lecture brilliantly at the École Normale Supérieure, Anzieux was analysed by him, but Lacan never mentioned the fact that he had already worked with his mother. This is how Anzieux describes the significance of his mother in his choice of career. This is quote 21. I might put it this way, it sounds banal, but in my case it seems true. I became a psychoanalyst to care for my mother. Not so much to care for her in reality, even though I did succeed in helping her in the last quarter of her life to find a relatively happy, balanced life. What I mean is to care for my mother in myself and other people. To care in other people for this threatening and threatened mother. I'm very interested in this metaphor of the mother inside the child because it's just spatially terribly, terribly interesting. I don't have time, obviously, for a full biography, but there's more detail in the introduction to this book. But I just want to end the life, with one more comment by Anzieux about his origins, and this is he's talking about 1943 now. In 1943, Marguerite was freed. She was actually in hospital for a very long time, and she wasn't really doing, she was doing rather well running the library and being quiet and quite religious. But anyway, she I must say, the other coincidence is that she became housekeeper to Lacan's father. She says the son hadn't changed a bit or something. Like that. Anyway, this is Anzieux now. In 1943, Marguerite was freed. Her husband asked for a divorce. Another drama. I was going to say psychodrama. Marguerite's family rose up against René and scuppered his plan of legalizing his union with his sister-in-law. A fresh scandal. But also for the adolescent son, what an experience to find himself confronting the private psychosis of a mother and the neurosis of the family group. And what luck to have been sustained by the competitive three-way love of his father and two women. What an introduction to the twin knowledge of Oedipus and Narcissus. Yes, the history of this child is the epitome of banality. I've got a little time, I think, I hope, to say a little bit about his theory, so I'm going to rather go through it fast, because obviously I'd hope you'll read the book and find out everything there. The idea of the skin ego, the mwapu, is premised on the central importance of the body to psychical life. In Freud's time, and I'm quoting here, Anzieux says, what was repressed was sex. But in the 1970s and 80s, when he started writing about the skin ego, the repressed issue was the body. Since Lacan, the stress on language had meant that the body was not being psychoanalytically theorized. Again, I'm quoting him. Yet, quote 24, every psychical activity leans analytically on a biological function. And his aim was to fill that gap. Psychical space and physical space constitute each other in reciprocal metaphors, he wrote in 1990. The skin ego is one of these metaphors. Actually, when I gave this presentation, somebody said to me, "What if they are they just metaphors? Is it just a metaphor?" But of course, a metaphor is not just a metaphor, so I think we can go on. And here he gives a sort of a social context for the relevance of the skin at this point. This is quote 26. Ever since the Renaissance, Western thought has been obsessed with one epistemological notion, the idea that we acquire knowledge by breaking through an outer shell to reach an inner nucleus or kernel. This notion is now exhausted, after having achieved some successes and also created many serious dangers. After all, it was nuclear physics that led scientists and the military to the point of atomic explosions. As early as the 19th century, neurophysiology called a halt to this, though it was not much noticed at the time. The brain is, in fact, the upper and frontal section of the encephalon. The cortex, the word means bark or shell in Latin, and entered the vocabulary of anatomy in 1907, denotes the outer layer of grey matter that caps the white matter. We are faced with a paradox. The centre is situated at the periphery. What if thought were as much a matter of the skin as of the brain? And what if the ego, now defined as the skin ego, had the structure of a wrapping? I'll come back to wrapping eventually, so I think I'll come back. Oh, actually, perhaps I won't, but you can ask me, or you can accuse me of this later.
I'll mention wrapping.
You'll mention wrapping. He's going to mention wrapping, thank you. The skin, like any shell or peel, has a double surface. A protective, this is quoting Anzieux, quote 27, protective layer on the outside, and underneath it, or in its orifice, is the other, which collects information and filters exchanges. And this is the complex structure of surfaces, rather than that old image of thought penetrating through into a truth core that can help us understand our physical, psychical, and intellectual worlds in a different way. And I have to say that one of the reasons why I was so keen on Anzieux when I first came across him is that it seems to me that psychoanalysis is in dire need of a central body part which does not distinguish one sex from another sex, but which, because once you're talking about skin, you're talking about the skin having certain particularly sensitive zones, and those sensitive zones exist on both in both sexes. I find that terribly important as a feminist. Anyway, in the earliest days of the baby, it not only receives care, but also gives out signals to its family circle. It's no passive partner in the mother-child dyad, and there's a sort of feedback arrangement, which, however, is not kind of exactly balanced, but there is. And it exchanges looks, smiles, noises, and sense impressions. And, quote 28, it acquires a power of endogenous mastery that develops from a sense of confidence into a euphoric feeling of unlimited omnipotence. Babies, he says, have a bodily pre-ego which helps them to develop as individuals. And this is based on reliable feedback from a twinned other of a kind that will be echoed later in love relationships. Of course, he talks a great deal about pathologies or all these different kinds of connections and all these different significances of the skin. Touch, he says, is the first sense faculty to develop embryonically, and thus, quote 30, the skin is the basic reference to which we spontaneously relate the various other sense data. That interests me particularly, the relation between touch and other sense experiences, and he calls this consensuality, which was the title I gave to a book I did on him and various other things. So, to have an ego, it's quote 31, is to be able to turn in on oneself. The baby then develops the fantasy of an interface represented as a skin common to the mother and child. I'll put the glass down, because the way he describes that is something like this, that if one moves, the other moves, and it's a sort of back-to-back. There are also places in the book where he's talking about being contained inside the container, and there is another container which perpetually contains. It's slightly like Russian dolls, but I think a bit more complicated than that. So there's also an illusion of reciprocal inclusion, as I say, which is revived later, this is quote 33, in life, in the experience of being in love, in which each of the lovers encloses the other in their arms while at the same time being enclosed by them. But of course, pathology can attend any of these relations. In brief, Anzio describes 8 main functions of the skin ego, which each develop aspects of the metaphor linking skin and self, and lead later to 8 corresponding functions of the thought ego. I mean, people will probably be getting echoes of Bion. I mean, I've read a little Bion, but I've read a great deal more Anzio, so, and he's very readable indeed. So there's some quite similar things going on there. He obviously quotes him. So the 8 functions are holding, or maintenance, handling, or containing, contenance, protection against stimuli, par excitation, in Freud, Reizschutz, individuation, which is the same in French, consensuality, or intersensoriality, sexualization, libidinal recharging, and finally, inscription or signification. But he also has, like the fairy at the christening, there's a 9th one that pops in at the end, which is a negative one, called toxicity, activité toxique. I've only got time for a couple of more points, and I'm going to check my time before I see if I can do my last section or not. Anzio's field of reference is unusually vast, including embryology, ethology, mathematics, and neurophysiology. Among psychoanalysts and those in allied fields, he cites, I'm just being alphabetical here, Abraham and Turek, Esther Bick, Bion, Bowlby, Barry Brazelton, Paul Feydan, Freud, of course, André Green, Harry Harlow, René Caez, Jean Laplanche, Donald Meltzer, Ashley Montague, Michel de Musan, Mahmoud Sami Ali, Paul Schilder, René Spitz, Francis Tustin, and of course Winnicott. So it's kind of all the alphabet. But very much of the skin ego, which is another reason I like it so much, and it was a pleasure to translate, is taken up with examples from literature, and often quite popular literature. He's talking very often about science fiction stories. Do I have time? Another 5-ish minutes. Okay, I wanted to just give 2 examples, which are slightly more extended scenes from him. Which I think are showing you how the theory of the skin ego works when he gives you a practical, this is something that's happening and this is how I'm going to analyse it. So the first one is in his discussion of the wrapping of warmth. And I will talk about wrapping if you want me to. Anyway, I'll just read this first. Quote 34. An interesting phenomenon has often been observed in the practice of relaxation therapy. A patient arrives early and, finding themselves alone in the room, starts the first exercise. Quickly and pleasantly, they begin to feel warm all over their body. The therapist eventually arrives, and at once the patient stops feeling warm. The patient tells this to the therapist, who also happens to be a psychoanalyst, and the latter tries in vain, through dialogue, to elucidate and eliminate the cause of the loss of warmth. The psychotherapist then decides to remain silent and relax as well, leaving the patient to experience what Winnicott, 1958, calls being alone in the presence of someone who respects one's solitude while protecting it by their proximity. Little by little, the patient then recovers that total sensation of warmth. How are we to understand this observation? When a patient is alone in a room they're familiar with and comfortable in, they experience their self as expanded and elated, which extends the boundaries of their bodily ego to the dimensions of the room. the good feeling of having a skin ego that's growing ever larger and yet also belongs to them alone, brings back the earliest experience of having a wrapping of warmth. When the psychotherapist comes in, the spell is broken. Yeah. It's broken suddenly and traumatically. For the wrapping is both too big and too fragile. The barrier of warmth, he says, is a poor protective shield. With the warmth gone, the patient tries, with the help of the therapist, to find a new anaclysis to support their skin ego. This could be the archaic fantasy of a skin common to two partners. But instead of touching the patient's body, the therapist is talking, and the patient resists this regression. The patient only recovers that all-encompassing feeling of warmth once the terror of invasion has dissipated and their bodily ego has shrunk back to dimensions closer to those of their own body. The discreetly protected presence of the therapist, analogous to the silent benevolent neutrality of a psychoanalyst, leaves the patient free to recover a skin ego by identifying with the confident skin ego of the therapist. And actually, when I last gave this paper, somebody said, why should the skin ego of the therapist always be confident? So, yes, that's in bracket. But he finishes, thus the patient avoids the triple risk of stealing another person's skin, having their own skin stolen by another person, or being dressed in the poisoned gift of the other person's skin, which would stop them ever having a skin of their own. The wrapping of warmth extends outwards from the bodily ego to the psychical ego and envelops the self. I'll leave that one now and just quickly tell you the other one, which is about a Burns victim. This is the wrapping of suffering. And here he's quoting a case report by a young colleague, Emmanuel Moutin, who worked as a psychologist in a Burns unit. The patient, who's being called Armand, was, quote 35, a prisoner who'd attempted autolysis by fire. He was in considerable pain, and on this occasion he'd called a nurse to give him extra painkillers. The nurse was willing, but she'd been delayed, and in the meantime the psychologist sat and talked to him. Now I'm quoting. When at last the nurse came back with the analgesics, he refused them, saying with a big smile, "It's all right, I'm not in pain anymore." He was as surprised as anyone. We, this is Emmanuel, the psychologist, we continued our conversation, and afterwards he fell asleep peacefully without the help of drugs. This is Anzieux's comment. Having a young woman sitting beside him who was not interested in his body, but purely in his psychical needs, the lively and lengthy dialogue that developed between them, the re-establishment of an ability to communicate with another person, and thus with himself, enabled this patient to rebuild a skin ego that was able to allow his skin, despite his physical injuries, to exercise its functions of protecting against external attack and containing painful affects. The skin ego had lost its biological dependency on the skin. Instead, through talking and through the conversation with himself and the symbolizations that grew out of it, it had found another anaclysis, a sociocultural one. Remember, he says, the skin ego works through multiple anaclitic supports. The skin of words harks back to the bath of speech in which a baby is immersed by people talking to it or by it crooning to them. Then, when the child develops the ability to think verbally, the skin of words provides a symbolic equivalence of the softness, suppleness, and relevance of contact by taking the place of the faculty of touch, which has become impossible, forbidden, or painful. And that's where I stop and tell you to read the book, not that one, but my Oh, I know. Well, it's at the beginning. It was at the beginning, but it doesn't matter. I won't run it back. Yes, I will run it back. Well, that's on the front of the book. I actually changed the cover illustration because there have been so many nasty cover illustrations of people being flayed. Whereas this is a painting he talks about at some length. Shall I? I think we should go straight on. And I think you might like this.
I have to attach it to myself. What is it?
I don't know, but it's important.
Part of my skin ego.
Yeah, you just stick it in his pocket.
Okay. Can you just... Great. Okay, well, I'm not going to speak for very long. I've seen Naomi do that paper twice now. No, that was... That wasn't a reproach at all. It was just to say that each time I've been struck by how you actually have conformed in many ways to your portrait of the kind of very retiring translator. Yeah. Because you haven't actually brought yourself into it. I mean, you've talked about Strachey, you've talked about Freud, you've talked about Anzieu, but I just thought it might be nice to actually spend my very brief slot actually shining a light on Mary as a translator in the text. I mean, there are lots of other things. I mean, first of all, before I do that, that's all I'm going to do. I want to say thanks so much for allowing me to read your, you know, to be part of this event and to immerse myself in your book. Because it is your book, I think. You know, in so many ways, you've redone Anzieu's book. And it's just, I work as a lecturer in film, and it's just made me think, three films I've taught this year, all of which could be totally revitalized through Anzieu. So, Les Yeux Sans Visage, Eyes Without a Face, by Georges Franju. I mean, an Anzieu reading of that would be amazing. Mysterious Skin, by Greg Araki, fantastic film. And finally, Almodóvar is the Skin I Live In. I mean, all of these, just crying out. Anzieu via Naomi Siegel rereading. Anyway, so what I want to do though in the 5 minutes or so I'm going to speak is just read a passage from Naomi's new translation of the Anzieu. I went back to the original, Le Moi Pour, and thanks to Naomi as well, she happened to have a copy of the previous English translation, the Christina translation, so I've had a look at that as well. And I just wanted to read a passage which I think brings out really nicely just some of the, well, I would call them very alive innovations that Naomi's translation has been able to bring to the surface. So I've chosen a passage from near the end of the book, one of my favourite chapters from the book, which is the Film of Dreams. So it's a case history about a young woman called Zenobie. In Turner's translation, he calls her Zenobia. Naomi preserves the Frenchness of Zenobie. In any case, it's a deliberately kind of exotic name. It's Zenobie. He names her after an ancient character, a dethroned queen, because the patient has been dethroned from her position of being the eldest child by the arrival of a younger child. Okay, so I'm just going to read a passage of about a page or so, and then just say very briefly a few things that I like about Naomi's translation, that's all. Okay, so this is from the middle of the case history. Her summer holidays passed off without difficulties and without any disruptive actings out. But when we started up again, she fell into a major regression. In the 45 minutes of the session, she went through a massive experience of emotional distress. She relived the whole agony of being abandoned by her mother. The details of this suffering, which she'd been able to recover and put into words, clearly showed how far her skin ego had developed. She had achieved the wrapping that could contain her psychical states and the doubling of the conscious ego that enabled her to observe herself and symbolize the parts of her that were ill. She brought out three kinds of detail, which I grouped together each time in my interpretation. First of all, I explained that she'd suffered at being abandoned by her mother, being dethroned from the position of only child. We already knew this theoretically, but she needed to recover the feelings of intense suffering which she had both experienced and repudiated at the time. Second, I proposed a hypothesis which had suggested itself to me during the recent period of mirroring transference. Even during the time she was an only child, the communication between her and her mother had not been strong. Zenobie's mother had given her plenty of food and cuddles, but she had not considered the baby's inner feelings enough. In response to this, Zenobie told me that her mother would shout at the least little thing, which I associated with her fear of loud noises breaking in on her. She had been unable to distinguish for sure, in her own feelings, what came from her mother and what came from herself. Loud noises expressed someone's fury, but she did not know whose. Thirdly, I suggested that this failure to take her primary sensations, affects, and fantasies into account had no doubt been reinforced by her father, and from this point on, my patient was able to evoke explicitly the latter's jealous, violent character. That session was one of extreme and prolonged emotional intensity. Zenobie sobbed and seemed on the brink of collapse. I warned her in advance when the session would finish so that she could prepare herself inwardly for the ending. I assured her that I was taking on her suffering and that she was going through, perhaps for the first time, an emotion so powerful that she had never before allowed herself to feel it, and had sealed it, removed it, and enclosed it in a sort of cyst at the periphery of herself. She stopped crying, but was walking unsteadily as she left. This suffering, which she had at last made her own, had created a wrapping for her ego that strengthened her sense of the unity and continuity of herself. The following week, Zainabi had reverted to her usual defense mechanisms. She said that she never again wanted to go through such a painful experience in her analysis. Then she mentioned the fact that she'd been dreaming a lot, constantly, every night since she came home from holiday. She had not intended to tell me about this. In the next session, she announced that she decided to tell me about her dreams, but as there were too many of them, she grouped them into three categories. The beauty queen dreams, the dreams of spheres. I had forgotten the third category, as I did not have the chance to write it all down at the time, being overwhelmed by the profusion of material. Session after session, she reported her dreams, both in detail and in bulk. I was drowning in it, or rather, giving up the attempt to retain, understand, or interpret, I let myself be carried by the flood. In the first category of dreams, she was, or she saw, a very beautiful girl whom some men were about to strip naked in order to examine her beauty. As for the second category, the sphere dreams, she interpreted them herself, relating them to the breast or testicles. She picked up this point and added, "The sphere is a breast testicle head." She recalled the everyday expression, "to lose your marbles," meaning to go off your head. So that's it. I just think it's beautiful in French, it's really beautiful in Naomi's version. I think it's slightly less beautiful in Chris Turner's version. I don't want to do down Chris Turner's version because I think it's got some very good things about it. But what I think is so great about Naomi's version is that it is just more English. It's more alive and it's more emotionally real. Just a few things I draw your attention to. Naomi changes the tense. So in the original French, it's related in the present, and Chris Turner retains the present, but it just doesn't sound as good. The literary quality that it's lent by Naomi's translation, I think, is appropriate. So it's a case of being quite an audacious translator, but one whose audacity is, I think, entirely justified. Naomi also goes further in her translation than Chris Turner does. He leaves a lot of things in French untranslated, interestingly. So passage à l'acte remains passage à l'acte in Turner, but Naomi says acting's out. I think we need it to be acting's out. She does that even more impressively at the end of the passage I cited, which is with the boule, the whole thing about boule and spheres. In the French, it's boule. In the Turner retains the term boule. He doesn't translate boule. Naomi, however, works hard, thinks, and talks about spheres, and then links that to losing your marbles, which is such a wonderful, it's a stroke of genius. But then on the same page also, just to help us, adds a little one of her rare translator's notes, which she's very judicious about, but I think it's a really useful translator's note. So I think we get the best of both worlds from the translation, a kind of very English, natural translation, but also one which allows us, through the notes, to see what the original French was and to try to make our own links if we want to. Just a couple more examples. Sentence retranslations which just bring the affect and the intensity of Zainabi's experience more closely and directly into English. So that lovely phrase, "Zainabi's mother had given her plenty of food and cuddles," very different from Turner's version, which is much colder, actually, much more Latinate, closer to the French. But food and cuddles is great. And then a little bit later, even more intensely. Blah blah blah. I assured her I was taking on her suffering. She was going through, perhaps for the first time, an emotion so powerful she'd never before allowed herself to feel it, and had sealed it, removed it, and enclosed it in a sort of cyst at the periphery of herself. In the original French, it's insisté. In the Turner version, it remains insisted. But who would say insisted? I think there's something great about the concreteness and the physicality and the bodily reality of retained it enclosed it in a sort of cyst. There's something very brutal and real about that translation. So that is, I think, all I want to say. Thanks very much.
Yes, I'll take the turner back. Maligned turner.
Thank you.
You're okay with this?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I don't know
you
what to do.
You have to click it to yourself somehow. But if you can be assisted.
Okay. Here? If that's it. Oh, okay. There.
Hi, good evening. Well, my class will be a bit sort of, in a way, of course, we're here celebrating our colleague and friend Naomi Siegel for this huge achievement, the translation of the DNCS Skin Ego. I was very privileged to be asked a few years ago for a review of Naomi's earlier book, Consensuality, the DNCS Gender and the Sense of Touch. It was really amazing. I was able to learn a lot about anxious theories. I had been not very much aware, but I had been aware, but really not completely into that until I read that book of Naomi about the body and the skin. That time, a few years ago, it was most topical because the psychoanalysis began then to focus its attention to the body, not before, not properly had been acknowledged before. As Alessandra Lema said in some lecture, taking the body back into psychoanalysis. So in other words, really was not properly acknowledged. But now, Naomi has gone much forward with this translation, and obviously her obvious passion about Ancien's work, with this wonderful and very much, I think I agree with you, very much needed translation, because it has opened a new world of understanding of this important work with the unique importance of the body and the skin, body connection. In a way, to me, because I deal with forensic patients are those who commit acts against society, or who are very violent, or who suffer from perversions. So from that point of view, it was really quite an open door to get to know more and more and more about my patients too. So, and gave me a lot of, in a way, unexpected insights to the life of forensic patients. Before this, though, I'd like also to endorse my gratitude to both Ancien and Siegel's work, and I would like to endorse Naomi's wonderful details of creativity and frustration attached to the process of translation. And I must say, I'm very aware about these crucial processes of translating important works. And I'm very full of admiration about Naomi for making this important work so available to the understanding in the English language, as our colleague before has already told us. And also I was reminded about they are new in the sense of doing the Greek tragedies, translated by Anne Carson, some of them last year at the theater in Islington. And she also talks about the problem of untranslability. And she offers different examples about how difficult it is, from the Greek miasma to the five men and this and that and the Antigone and the problem about, in Aristotle, the plot being most effective in recognition and the reverse that happened at one blow. And I think that this is all extremely interesting and very much also conveying the complex interactions of the metaphorical system in the inevitability of the catastrophe to which it could lead, the bad translation, it could really produce a catastrophe, really. I began to think, funny enough, about the interaction of the skin, the baby, and the mother, and I had a paragraph in my first book, Mother, Madonna, Whore, in which I talked about the sense of bliss that is achieved when the mother's breasts are full of milk, the baby is crying because it's hungry, and these two is a blissful union that comes together in the most sort of family function there. And if we, all of us, or any of us, expected this to happen later in life, forget about it. Forget. This is absolutely ridiculous. It's, I began to say, perhaps this is what people feel about translation, that you want to get into that sort of a skin situation too, and the sort of, that blissful union in which you make it so clear. And it is very, very difficult, but I think that you have done a fantastic job, though. I said there are two areas of insight and clarification which emerge very clearly in this new translation and very helpful in the field of forensic psychotherapy. For example, ANSI's recognition of the transgenerational factors operating in a completely unconscious manner in the way that the offended patients behave or react what seems to be irrational behavior. Everybody, irrational behavior, we have to wonder, what do we mean by that? Perhaps we're being lazy, intellectually lazy, not to be able to really to try to understand what's going on there. I have my feeling, because I have written a bit about replacement child. And the fact that this, the two of them, and his mother, are both replacement children. Now, when Margaret Ancier behaves, you know, she's scared about being a criminal mother and all that, but behaves in this way that attacks, in the physical way, this very famous actress, which takes him to prison and all that, and then to analysis with Lacan. I was wondering about that. Perhaps it appears crazy, but perhaps it's a very logical reaction to be confronted with a sort of the real child, the one before her who died. The one who dies is always the perfect, is always the flawless. And the one who survives is always never, is always is completely, hasn't got any chance to survive in any good way. So it's all, and we have that a lot in our forensic patients, in criminal behavior and all that. So I was wondering if she feels, in a way, in the terrible confrontation with this dead sister before her, and that, who is the famous, the beautiful and all that, and being the sort of irrational behavior may have evoked in her a vocation of something that is not even, she's not even conscious about, but it is there inside her. So the degree of sorts of humiliation about this very important and beautiful woman, where she is there, sort of really not very much. So it may be that this is responding to that, also is a transgenerational transmission of trauma. We could say also that what Ancier does, like a lot of us, we do, we go into psychotherapy too, because of the trauma that then we try to understand and to go forward as he is doing too. Now, the other another extreme aspect is that the importance of the touching, senses and specifically the meaning of the touch from birth. Now, the earliest contact between mother and child is very much explored in different manifestations. This illuminates very much transgression and the risks when applied to the psychodynamic therapy of forensic patients. Don't you ever dare, if you have a forensic patient, offended patient, ever to touch that patient, because that will produce the most explosive reaction. So I think that is something there that he is also conveying in a very clear way about the need to transmit the empathy, but not by making a physical contact such as touching or attempting to hold the patient's hand. This is of high importance to maintain and to establish a very strict sense of boundaries in the field of forensic psychotherapy, which sometimes people do not know and they really behave in a different way, trying to be nice, trying to be kind to their patients. Somebody said, you know, I don't think nobody has ever loved me in my life. And then somebody who had not experienced touched the patient and thought, oh, I like you, and the patient exploded and just all the room went into bits and pieces. So we are very much aware about this. Now, since I became familiar with Didier Ancier's theory of psychic envelope, I think that now you didn't talk about this, but it's very apt now translated into a different way. Instead of envelopes, now I mean it's calling that wrapping. And I think it's very apt the way she's doing that. I have been very interested about this because of the significant helping understanding perversion too. I have used them to comprehend the complexities and layering processes which are involved, for example, in rubber fetishism, and most specifically in a psychoanalytical therapy of a patient suffering from autoerotic asphyxia. This, I have documented this paper in a paper called Dancing with Death. And other rewarding aspects I have found also by reading is concerns his wife, Annie Ancier, his wife and collaborator and partner. She began to write about some concepts in 1989, were written and published, called La Femme Sans Qualité. And they closely resemble my own theories published in 1988, Mother, Madonna, Whore, from which were born out of my own extensive clinical practice. Ancier were deduced from theoretical notions deriving from a completely different psychoanalytical and ideological context. In her words, she says, quote, "It is clear that the sexual investment in the object is directed mainly in the woman, towards the inside, whereas in the man it is uniquely directed towards the outside." And this is exactly mirrors my own assertion that the main difference between female and male perversions is in the aim, whereas in men is directed towards the outside, in women is against themselves or acts of their own creations, in other words, their own child, their own children. Also, I was very touched by the ancient big interest in group therapy, which later is taken by Caes. And so they say that was because of his lack of siblings and the sort of trying to, this haunting, that sister haunting him or whatever. But I think it's very good. His book also is another book, perhaps it was later at some point, The Group and the Unconscious, and which also I find fascinating because of my own interest, my own very extensive work in group analytical situation with forensic patients, which I think sometimes is absolutely essential therapy for these patients. But I just feel like we have to congratulate Naomi for this fantastic achievement. Perhaps you have to go down for drinks. Thank you very much.